their scuba gear and wetsuits waiting for them, and planned each step of the journey. In the midst of their preparations, Selma came in. "Have got the licenses you asked for?"
"What licenses?" asked Remy.
"For carrying concealed firearms in Guatemala. These are copies, but the originals will be waiting at your hotel in Guatemala City. It's concealed carry only, by the way. Wearing a gun openly is frowned upon. I guess after their civil war, it's intimidating."
"Thanks, Selma," said Remy.
"I've also transferred GPS maps of the Alta Verapaz region of Guatemala to your satellite phones. You should memorize the coordinates of the site because I didn't want to program that in. I did include the numbers of the U.S. Embassy and Consulate in Guatemala City and the local police. There has been a lot of crime in the area recently, and sometimes Americans look like good people to kidnap for ransom."
"We'll be careful," said Remy.
"Please do. Don't take offense, but you two even look rich. I'm glad to see you're packing the clothes you wore doing relief work in Mexico. Keep your equipment invisible."
"Thanks for the reminder," said Sam.
"One more thing," Selma said. "Dave Kane says the university has assigned him a good place to work on the Codex. There's a real full-scale safe in the library's archival department and a spare room beside it where he can work. When he's done each day, he can lock the Codex in the safe again."
"That should do fine," Sam said.
Remy said, "Now it's our turn to tell you to be careful."
"That's right," said Sam. "If either of you is watched or followed, don't go to the university. Drive to the police station."
"Don't worry," she said. "Have a successful trip. Call frequently and come back soon. I promise, Zoltan will think he's on vacation."
In 12 hours, Sam and Remy were on a flight heading toward Guatemala City.
Chapter 10. Guatemala City. Sam and Remy disembarked in Guatemala City and went through customs. They were about to leave the airline terminal when Remy's satellite phone rang. She answered and said, "Hi, Selma. You must have tracked our plane."
"Of course. We've found something amazing, and I thought you should know."
"What is it?"
"Do you remember a sort of lump inside the cover of the Codex?"
"I do," Remy said. "It's sort of a rectangle shape. I figured it was a patch."
"It's a sheet of parchment, folded, and then placed under the outer layer and covered with the fig bark fabric. David and I removed it 2 hours ago. It's a letter written in black ink in Spanish. It says, 'To all of my countrymen, blessings. This book and other books of the Mayan people concern their history and their observations about the natural world. They have nothing to do with the devil. They must be preserved as a way to understand our charges, the Mayan people.'"
"Who's it from?" asked Remy.
"That's the surprise. It's signed Fra Bartolomé de las Casas, Prior of Rabinal, Alta Verapaz."
"Las Casas? The Las Casas?"
"Yes. The man who convinced the Pope that Indians were rational beings with souls and had rights. He practically invented the idea of human rights. Dave Kane is beside himself with excitement."
"Does the paper have a date on it?"
"Yes. January 23rd, 1537. We may not know everything about the Codex yet, but this is the second verification of the year it was hidden. We think Las Casas was trying to give the book safe passage, maybe while the man you found took it to that shrine on the volcano."
"It's fantastic," said Remy. "Be sure to make a copy of it."
"Well, get on with your trip. I just wanted you to know about this. And by the way, your vehicle is parked in the hotel lot under the name Señor de la Joya. I bought it online, so you'd better look it over before you leave civilization."
"We'll do that," said Sam. We'll talk soon. Sam and Remy checked into the hotel suite Selma had reserved and collected the documents and the equipment that were waiting for them. Then they went outside to the parking lot behind the building and found the car. It was a 10-year-old Jeep Cherokee with chips and scratches that showed it had originally been red, but at some point had been painted over olive drab with a paintbrush. They started it, drove it around the block for a few minutes with the windows closed so Sam's engineer ears could pick up any sounds that might mean trouble, and then opened the hood and checked the belts, hoses, battery, and fluid levels. When Sam had crawled under and looked it over, he stood again. Not pretty, but not bad either. The back seat and the floor behind it provided plenty of space for all the equipment they intended to bring. They stopped at a station, filled the tank, bought 2 metal 5-gallon cans, and filled them too. That evening, they marked their maps to plot a route up 14 north toward Corban in the north-central part of the Verapaz district, and then on to Xucsul in the Rio Candelaria region. In early morning, they loaded their gear, their dive equipment, and the large backpacks that held the small cache of clean clothes and supplies. Each of them also carried a pair of Smith & Wesson M&P 9mm pistols, one in a backpack pocket with 6 loaded 7-round single-stack magazines, and the other in a belly band under a loose shirt. As the old car moved along the road, it seemed always to be laboring. Alta Verapaz ranged in elevation from 1,000 to 9,000 feet. At times the car seemed to grind upward as though it were dragging itself up a rope coiled around its axle. At others, the car careened downward while Sam fought for control. They were able to make snack and bathroom breaks in the small towns along the way. Remy, whose Spanish had been getting plenty of practice, used these opportunities to ask about the road ahead. On one of the stops, Sam said, "What do you think of our adventures so far?" She said, "I'm glad we just spent weeks climbing a volcano and then walking from town to town doing heavy labor." "Why?" "Because now my body knows that no matter how hard this ride is, I should enjoy every second of it, because when it ends, life could get a whole lot harder." At Corban, they spent a night at a small hotel and slept deeply. They were up early to prepare to leave for Xucsul. The people they met seemed to be a mixture of Mayan farmers and Hispanic visitors. They knew that the farther from big cities they went, the more likely that they would reach places where people not only didn't speak English, but didn't speak Spanish either. When they were back in the Cherokee, they found the roads got narrower and rougher by the mile. After another hour, Remy looked at the map and then her watch. "We should be in Xucsul soon." 5 minutes later, they drove through the village. It was only about 100 yards long. Sam and Remy stepped out of the car at the edge of the village and stood in the gravel road. Sam and Remy looked at each other. The silence was profound. Off in the distance, a dog barked, and the spell was broken. A few people came out of buildings and looked in their direction, as though the arrival of a car was an occasion for curiosity. One by one, they lost interest and went back to their homes. The gravel road turned into a rutted cart path. "I hope the Jeep is up to this. At least there seems to be a trail, but we're in for a bumpy ride," said Sam. "I hope what trail we have is going in the right direction. I'm not looking forward to blazing one through the jungle," Remy replied. "I was hoping the machetes were just for show." Remy looked up at the sky, then at Sam. "It's a long time before we run out of daylight. At least 6 hours. Each took a drink of water from his or her canteen, took out a machete, put it where it would be easy to reach, and then they began to drive up the trail. For a time, Sam would periodically check his satellite phone's GPS to be sure they were still heading in the direction they intended. The trail was winding and required steady climbing as it took them into the highlands of Alta Verapaz. Before darkness came, they stopped and pitched their tiny tent, with its floor and zippered netting to keep the insects out. They cooked some dehydrated rations on a small fire and then slept. In the morning, they searched for water and found a couple of gallons that had been caught in a half-hollowed log. They filled two plastic containers, put in their military-grade purification tablets, and secured them in the back of the jeep. For each of the next 5 days, they followed the same routine, checking the GPS each day to be sure they were on course. As they drove farther from the populated areas, they were surrounded by squads of chattering monkeys in the trees overhead, flocks of birds flying over at dawn and dusk, and many smaller birds that were invisible in the dense foliage calling out to one another. On the third day, the trail took them down from the crest of a high hill into a valley surrounded by smaller hills, the trail opening up to a surface that had been leveled by human activity. There were big trees growing in places, and fallen leaves had turned to a thick humus and then become dirt, and then smaller plants had died, rotted, and then been overshadowed by taller neighbors. And even those trees had died, fallen, and rotted, several long generations of them. But the strip of land where this had happened was still flat. Remy and Sam looked at the low hills that rose on their right, and then the ones on their left. They got out of the jeep. Sam put his compass on a level spot, raised its mirror, and used it to sight along the space at the foot of the hills on their right. "Perfectly straight," he said. He paced off the width of the flat space, from one hill to the one opposite. 50 of my paces," he said. "Let's try it farther along. I'll grab the pack with the machetes and folding shovels." Sam and Remy walked 200 yards, then set the compass again and sighted along the foot of the next hill and the one beyond it. Sam paced the width of the flat strip.
"I assume it's 50, said Remy.
"Of course."
"What do you think the hills were?"
"From what I've read, they could have been anything. They used to put up buildings on top of the earlier ones."
"Which do you prefer?" she said.
"Would you rather dig down below our feet to establish that it's paved, or climb up there and dig to see if the hill is a building that was overgrown by the jungle?"
"If we're way up there, we might be able to see for a distance," he said.
"That's what I think, too," she said.
"It might be nice to look above the treetops for a change." They left their packs, took their machetes and folding shovels, and climbed. The hill they chose was the center one on the right side. It appeared to be the highest. The hill was steep, rising to a height of about 125 feet, and its slopes were thick with plants and small trees, which they used as handholds. When they reached the apex, Sam unfolded the shovel and began to dig. After about 4 shovelfuls, his blade hit stone. He used his machete to test a few spots nearby, and the sound was the same. Remy walked a few yards to get past a thicket of saplings growing on the top of the building.
"Don't get lost," Sam said.
"Come here," she said. "You've got to see this."
He took the machete and shovel with him and went through the thicket to find Remy, looking out over the tops of the jungle trees. From here, the canopy looked solid, but there were a few places where it was sparse. She pointed down at the level area they had left.
"It's like a wide road. It starts here and runs between the hills in a straight line. But it runs only a few 100 yards.
"And over there," Sam said, "another flat strip comes in at an angle and meets it."
"There's another over there," said Remy.
6 strips coming in from 6 directions to meet at one spot."
"It looks like an asterisk with a high wall circling the center," Sam said.
"You could fly over this area 100 times and not really see it," Remy said. "The trees make everything seem natural. The shapes are rounded off, but I'll bet this hill we're standing on is a pyramid."
"It's something big anyway," Sam said.
"Well, I guess we know where we have to go."
"Of course," she said. "The place where the roads meet."
When Sam and Remy reached the bottom of the steep hill, Remy said,
"This is creepy."
"What's creepy?"
"You know they're not hills. They're huge buildings covered with dirt and plants.
and these trees around us would be the only things that aren't creepy except that they're growing in the middle of this road. I feel like the people who lived here are watching us.
Trust me, they're not. He looked over his shoulder. Nope, not one ghost. But just in case, let's leave the Jeep here.
As they walked, Remy said, look at those trees. The cover was all pretty much the same until we got here. Now look, the trees are all in a straight line.
Sam stood beside her and sighted along the flat strip, where trees of all size and many species all ran along the center in a line. He stopped, shrugged off his pack, and began to dig a hole in line with the trees. The dirt was a rich, composted loam that came up easily. Shortly, he had a hole 3 feet wide and about 3 feet deep. Take a look, he said, and stepped out of the hole. Remy jumped in, looked down, and used her machete to probe the surface.
It's V-shaped and has a stone lining. It looks like an irrigation ditch.
Sam looked around him, turning his body slowly. I think it might be something else.
What?
Think back. Dave said that whatever else was going on in the Mayan world during the late classic period, it was made worse by droughts. 200 years of them, at least.
What do you think this was?
I think this flat space wasn't a road. The Mayans had no wheeled carts or tame animals to pull them, so why make it 50 paces wide? And it doesn't go anywhere. It looks like a plaza, except there are 6 of them in all directions. I think this place was designed to collect rainwater.
Of course, she said.
Both sides have a subtle slope down to the groove in the center, and the groove would direct the water where they wanted it. And that would explain why there are 6 strips leading inward from all sides. The place where they meet is the catch basin, Sam said. The 6 strips aren't roads. They're for catching rain and keeping it from washing away and sinking into the ground.
Let's go see if we're right, said Remy.
They hurried along the strip toward the spot where all 6 converged. At times, the brush and saplings came together to make their progress difficult. Here and there, the surface of the strip was bare even of leaves, cleared by some inundation during the rainy season. At last, they came to the end. The strip ran to the foot of an ancient stone wall about 15 feet high. The V-shaped ditch led to an opening in the bottom of the wall, where there was a hole about 10 inches wide. They walked around the circular wall and saw that each of the other 5 strips met the wall in the same way, bringing the water in through small openings at its foot. They found that the wall was not a circle with a gap in it for a door or gate. It was a spiral, so that the circular wall stretched for a full 360 degrees and then continued 10 degrees past the beginning spot, so it overlapped for about 10 feet to form a narrow, curved corridor ending in an entrance. Sam and Remy sidestepped along the corridor and found themselves inside the circular wall. In the center was a pool of water. They stepped to the edge and looked down. The pool was quite clear, about 30 feet deep. The bottom received no direct sunlight, at least not after the sun was low. The high stone enclosure around the pool included a walkway near the top that could be reached by a flight of steps.
"Why do you suppose they built a wall?" asked Remy.
"I don't know," said Sam. "Maybe during the last days of the city they needed to protect their water. Maybe it was the last line of defense if the city was taken. You could do worse than control the water supply in a siege. And look, this place is only about 30 feet wide. It would be easy to defend. The walls are about 6 feet thick at the bottom." He walked along the wall and picked up a loose rock, then looked across the enclosure. "This rock seems to be a plug. The other holes have fitted stones blocking them, too. That would protect the water from poison."
"I think it's time to let Selma and Dave know that we found it," said Remy.
"You're right," said Sam. "Let's take a few pictures and send them first thing so Dave can tell us what we've found."
Remy took pictures of the well, the pool, the curved entryway, and then stood on the battlement and took pictures in every direction. She added them to the pictures she had taken from the pyramid and on the strip and sent them. Then she waited a minute and called Selma.
Selma here. Fire away.
We've found it. We're on the site, and I've just sent you some pictures. Tell Dave Kane that the map is right. There's a pool of water here with a stone margin around it and a high wall above it. It's clear, and it seems to be quite deep, 30 feet or more.
What are those flat areas I'm seeing? Roads?
We think they're surfaces built to catch the rain and direct it here to the pool. They are all slightly tilted toward the center, and they go only a couple hundred yards. Sam stood close to Remy and said, "We also think the hills along the sides of the strips are buildings. One of them is quite large."
So the site could be a city.
Let's just say they invested a lot of labor on architecture, said Sam.
You've accomplished your mission, Selma said. Congratulations. Well done. Are you coming home?
Not just yet, Remy said. I think we'll dive the pool tomorrow morning and see what's down there. After carrying a scuba rig through a dry jungle, I want to make use of it.
I can't blame you, said Selma. I'll forward the pictures to David Kane right away, along with your description.
Good, said Sam. We'll talk to you soon. As they hung up, Sam said, We need to get the rest of the gear here. Do you want to drive the jeep down, or are you still worried about the ghosts?
Let's leave the jeep where it is and bring the gear. It shouldn't take more than a couple of trips with the other pack and the dive equipment.
They pitched their small tent in the enclosure around the pool, collected firewood in the nearby forest, and built a fire to boil a pot of water for their dehydrated food. After they'd eaten, they used the last hour of light to photograph the site from the nearest hills. As they were about to go to sleep, Sam's phone buzzed.
Hello?
Sam, it's Dave Kane.
Hi, Dave, Sam said. Then he put the phone on speaker.
The pictures are fantastic. You've proven the Codex is an accurate rendering, not a myth or vague historical rumors. From the looks of the place, it could have been a ceremonial center. The stone around it seems to be limestone, and the crumbling by the pool makes that seem even more likely. A sinkhole gets bigger as the limestone dissolves in the water.
We'll get a closer look tomorrow when we dive.
Be prepared for a sight, Kane said. The Mayans believed that everything depended on their relationships with a complicated pantheon of gods. They will almost certainly have tossed valuables into the pool as sacrifices to Chok, the rain god.
Whatever else went wrong here, it wasn't because of a lack of water.
We'll be waiting to hear.
Good night.
Chapter 11. Guatemala. Sam and Remy woke at dawn, and as soon as they'd had breakfast, began to prepare for exploring the pool. They put on their dive equipment. Each had an underwater flashlight, a net bag, and a dive knife.
I can't wait to get down there, Remy said.
I'm pretty curious myself, Sam said. Don't get carried away. Remember the buddy system. Stay close, no matter what's down there.
Agreed, she said. I may lose my enthusiasm if it's a pile of skeletons.
Ready?
Yes.
They lowered their masks and put their mouthpieces in, then slipped into the water. The water was cold and surprisingly clear. Now that the sun was rising higher, it shone deeper into the pool's depths. In a short time, they reached the bottom, which was all bare gray limestone. Finding nothing like the objects David Kane had told them to expect, they widened their search, shining their flashlights around them. Sam found a disc, lifted it, and brushed the limestone dust off it, and saw that it was made of green jade and was heavily carved. He showed Remy and bagged it. Remy caught a glint of something to her left, touched Sam's arm, and moved in that direction. When she did, she could tell that going that way was easier than it should be, as though there was a faint current. She moved beyond the circle of light from above into an area that was dark. The first object she found was a wide bracelet made of gold. She held it up so Sam could see, and he nodded. They moved along the limestone bed, picking up objects as they went. There were more carved objects of jade, and farther on, more pieces made of gold. There were discs, masks, necklaces, earplugs, bracelets, flat chest ornaments. They continued picking up objects for a time, and then Sam touched Remy's arm and pointed. The circle of light that had been directly above them at the start was now about 100 feet behind them. They had moved along, picking up the objects they'd seen, and now they'd drifted farther than they'd thought. Together they swam back toward the opening, bringing their net bags with them. When they reached the light, they slowly floated upward toward it, then broke the silvery surface. They took off their masks and held on to the side of the pool. Sam lifted his net bag to the deck above them, then Remy's. Next, he pulled himself onto the stone and held out his hand to Remy so he could pull her up.
"That was a lot of fun," she said. "You just dive down and pick up things where they threw them. It reminds me of an Easter egg hunt." "There's a bit of a current down there, though. The jewelry and things had all been moved downstream. If this place was abandoned at the end of the classic period, everything has been down there a while. A bit of a current can make a difference in 1,000 years.
"I'll bet some of the jewelry moved out of sight as it fell," she said.
"That's possible. When the people looked down and the gifts were gone, I'll bet they thought the gods had accepted them and been pleased. They laid out all their finds on the limestone surface and photographed them, then sent the pictures to Selma. They secured the finds in a zippered bag, placing them in Sam's pack.
"We haven't found everything that's down there," Remy said. "Don't you want to dive again this afternoon?"
"Whatever this place is, city, fort, ceremonial center, we're not going to find everything or learn everything about it in one trip. The archaeologists will be at it for years. The best we can do is verify what we can and get out."
"You're right," said Remy. "This is about the Codex, not about the two of us finding all the treasures in Guatemala.
I think we should spend the rest of today and tomorrow mapping, measuring, and photographing the complex. The next day we should get out of here before we run low on supplies."
"There are tapirs in the jungle. I can make you a nice tapir sandwich."
"I'm afraid that in another day tapir will start to sound good." After changing, they walked the length of each flat strip of land. It was nearly evening when they found a pair of stone pillars at the end of the third strip, placed like gateposts. They were about 8 feet tall and carved, one of them a male figure with the feathered headdress, shield, and war club of a king, and the other a female in a dress with a basket at her feet and a jug in her hands. There were Mayan glyphs in all the spaces around the two figures. Remy photographed the two from every angle and sent the photographs to Selma. She looked up from her phone.
"We're losing the sun. I'll take a couple of flash pictures just to be sure the writing is clear."
She took 2 flash photographs of each pillar, and then Sam grabbed her arm and pointed.
"Remy, look."
Up the hill, on the trail that Sam and Remy had followed to reach this site, they could see a line of men approaching. There seemed to be about 15 of them, and they were still a quarter mile off, but coming down the last gradual slope before the ruins.
"Uh-oh," she said. "I guess the flash was a bad idea."
"I don't know. Certainly not as bad as leaving the jeep out in the open for anyone to see," he said. "I can't tell if they've seen us, and I don't know if they're friendly or not. Maybe we can get back to the cenote and out of sight before they get here. That way we can avoid finding out." They began to trot, moving steadily toward the shelter of a stand of trees that had grown up in the center of the strip. As they did, Remy looked back. One of the men had stopped on the hill and was bringing a rifle up to his shoulder.
"Sam, run!"
There was the crack of a bullet as it passed over their heads, and about a second later the sound of the rifle shot reached their ears. The next sound was the explosion of the jeep, a gasoline fireball lighting the evening sky.
Sam and Remy were running hard now, weaving to keep the trees and brush between themselves and the men. They had the advantage of a level surface and a clear path where they could sprint without fear of tripping, while the men on the slope had to move along the hillside at an angle to avoid building up too much speed and tumbling down. Sam glanced over his shoulder as a second man stopped and shouldered his rifle. "Another one. Take cover!" They both went low and ducked behind a cluster of trees. There was another shot, and the bullet pounded into one of the trees, sending a shower of bark chips in all directions. Sam peered around the trunk and saw the man adjusting his telescopic sight. "Go!" Sam and Remy ran, working their way up to a full sprint as they approached the high wall surrounding the cenote. They ran around it to the far side and between the two layers of overlapping wall into the entryway. Sam began to pile loose stones in the narrow way to block it, while Remy went to their backpacks and retrieved their four pistols, spare magazines, and boxed ammunition. Each of them checked to be sure the guns were loaded.
"I can't believe this," Remy said. "Who could they be?"
"Nobody we want to know. They seem to have tracked us, following our trail, then opened fire as soon as they saw us."
"Who can they think we are?"
"Future dead people." He put his arm around her and gave her a hug. "Let's see if we can use this wall to stay alive."
"I'll go up to the walkway and see what they're up to."
"Keep your head low," he said. She pulled her baseball cap lower on her head.
"Unfortunately, we've been in these situations before."
"If we live through this one..." She put her finger on his lips.
"Shh, I know. Bubble baths and spa treatments. We've already made each other all the promises we need."
She took a pair of pistols and climbed to the walk along the top of the wall, found her way to a spot where the wall had crumbled a bit and left a small dip, then rose enough to survey the strip of land the men were approaching. Sam watched her bring her arm up to rest in the chink in the wall and begin to think through aiming her pistol. He had seen her do that before at competitions. Sam had been a respectable shot since the days when a member of a highly secret force had spent a month at a covert base instructing him in close-range shooting and sniper techniques. But Remy was in a different league. She had been shooting competitively since she was 12, a champion for whom the term nail-driving was not a figure of speech. Sam stood below her and spoke quietly.
"Get down, and stay there until you hear shooting."
Sam moved to the entryway, climbed over the barrier he'd built, sidestepped along the 10-foot overlap in the walls, and ran to the nearest stand of trees. He moved through the trees beside the level strip, getting closer to the space where the men would pass if they approached the walled pool. As he went, he studied the places he passed, aware that soon he would be running past them in the other direction. He took a position in the thick brush within an arm's length of the strip, but outside the causeway, where the plants had grown in fully. The men came at a run, carrying their rifles across their chests. They ran like they were chasing game, not like men who were about to meet an armed adversary. Sam crouched and waited. He had estimated 15 men, but he could see only 12. They wore khaki pants and short-sleeved civilian shirts and t-shirts. A few of them carried bolt-action hunting rifles with scopes, probably 4-power, because in these thick jungles, long shots across open space had to be rare. There were 2 men carrying shotguns, a weapon that probably put food in their bellies. 2 had pistols in holsters, and the others carried assault rifles that Sam identified as American AR-15s. Probably weapons that had found their way here during the Civil War. The man closest to Sam carried a hunting rifle. He raised it and took aim at the top of the wall around the pool. Sam was sure the man couldn't see Remy, but he was getting ready for her to stick her head up. A man who carried only a pistol stood by a tree and shouted in English,
"We know you're in there. Come out now and we'll make it easier for you."
Sam turned his head away from the men and called into the hills,
"We mean you no harm. Go away."
3 of the men half turned to see if someone had gotten behind them, and 1 turned around entirely, his gun ready. The spokesman said,
"We'll never go away. Come out, and we'll let you go away."
Sam could hear the bad news in the man's voice. These men thought they had found very easy prey, an American couple, undoubtedly unarmed and helpless. They were probably already estimating the ransom money, and even if they got it, they'd kill them both. Sam aimed his pistol at the nearest one, the man pointing his rifle at the top of the wall, waiting for a target to appear. The spokesman waved an arm, and the men moved forward toward the wall. Sam began to move with them to avoid being cut off from the entrance. The man near him sensed something and swung his rifle toward Sam, and Sam shot him in the chest, then dove into the low area beyond the brush. The man fell down, unconscious and gravely wounded. The others had seen him fall, and each fired in the direction he guessed the shot might have come from. Only two of them guessed right, and Sam's thicket was peppered with bullets. When Sam looked up, he saw that another man had fallen, one of the few carrying AR-15s. Remy must have shot him while the others were firing wildly, having picked him out as a high priority. The leader trotted over to the man's body, took the rifle and the man's pack. He aimed the rifle at the top of the wall, but Remy kept down, knowing the men all expected her to pop up and fire again. But Sam had a new problem. A man with a rifle was walking toward his thicket to see if Sam's body was lying there, or if he needed to be finished off. Now the man's feet were breaking sticks in the thicket. Sam located the sound and fired three times. The man's rifle went off, and Sam heard him fall. Sam crawled to him, his pistol ready, and found him lying with an entry wound in his forehead. Sam took the rifle, cycled the bolt, pulled himself to the edge of the thicket, and pushed the brush aside with the barrel. A man with a shotgun was moving along the foot of the wall. Sam aimed and fired, and the man fell dead. Sam cycled the bolt again and searched for another target. There was a man with a scoped rifle on a sling, climbing a tree so he could get a vantage into the walled enclosure. Sam aimed and fired, and the man went limp and fell 10 or 12 feet to the ground. He wasn't moving. Sam cycled the bolt again and realized that after one more shot he would be out of ammunition. He crawled toward the body of the man he'd taken the rifle from. But as he did, another man spotted him and cried out to the others. Sam was out of time. He fired, took the rifle with him, and ran into the jungle. He didn't stop, circling toward the walled enclosure around the pool. He couldn't hear any running footsteps behind him. As he ran, he removed the bolt from the rifle and tossed it into an impenetrable patch of low plants. 100 feet on, he threw the rifle into another patch and kept moving. He came around behind the enclosure, far from the entryway, and carefully stalked around the wall. As he came to the overlap, he saw a man crawling into it with a shotgun slung over his back. Sam fired a pistol round into the back of his head, knelt to take the shotgun, then heard a shot ricochet off the wall inches from his head. He leapt into the entryway just as a burst from an AR-15 turned the space he'd just occupied into exploding stone chips. He clambered over the stones piled in the passage and inside the wall. "Honey, I'm home," he called. "It's about time," she said. "I was worried sick." Sam climbed the steps, carrying the pump shotgun. "I counted them. There were 12 to start with, and now there are 6. "I know," she said. "At least we made it cost them something." "We did better than that. I'd say at the moment we're winning." She slowly shook her head. "There were more at first. At least 2 of them ran off into the woods about the time you did. I thought they might be after you, but then I saw them going back up the slope where they'd come from. They must be going for help." "Maybe now is our best chance to get out of here," said Sam. "Let's pack what we need in our backpacks, leave the rest, and make a run for it." "That's all we can do," she said. "Let's hope their main camp is far away." He set the shotgun down beside her. "You keep watch. Use this if one comes in range." He left the scuba gear, the tent, and most of the supplies. He packed the extra ammunition, the machetes, and the artifacts from the pool in his pack and left Remy's. He climbed up to the wall and picked up the shotgun. "All right, slip off into the woods and wait for me. I'll take one last look and see if I can..." He paused, looking at the expression on Remy's face. "What?" She pointed in the direction of the hillside. In the waning light, they could see a long line of men walking single file down the trail toward them. It's not 6 men anymore. It's 36. They must have heard all the gunshots and started this way to see what was up. Or maybe we're so far from civilization that they can use radios without being overheard.
I'm sorry, Remy, he said. I really thought we had a good chance.
She kissed his cheek.
You know, there's a lot to be said for bees. When somebody comes to wreck their hive to take their honey, the bees generally lose, but they make it as unpleasant and painful for him as possible. I respect that.
It's hard not to. Let's get every magazine loaded while we can still see, and don't forget the shotgun.
Right, said Sam. He went down the steps, crawled to the body of the man he had shot, took the man's day pack, and crawled back with it. There was a box with a dozen shells for the shotgun, but the rest was useless. A canteen, a hat, spare clothes, most of a fifth of whiskey. Sam gathered more stones from the crumbled area at the end of the pool and piled them in the passage, then carefully piled up their supply of firewood in case they needed to start a fire. He took the powerful flashlights they had brought for diving in the cenote, then climbed to the wall where Remy waited. He checked his pistols and hers to be sure they were fully loaded, then checked the 10 spare magazines and reloaded the 2 they'd emptied. See anything yet?
Nothing I can hit, she said. They're still way back, out of pistol range.
I think what they'll do is wait until it's fully dark and then move in close enough to hit us if we show ourselves for a second.
That's the time-honored method.
What are we planning to counter it?
I'm considering another time-honored method.
There were 6, then 8 rifle shots that hit along the top of the wall at intervals of about a yard.
Too late, she said. They're trying to keep our heads down so they can rush the entrance.
Sam clutched the shotgun and ran down the steps, then lay against the pile of rocks he'd built. 2 men appeared in front of him and he fired, pumped the shotgun and fired again. Then Sam pumped his shotgun a second time, grasped the barrel of one man's gun and dragged it inside with him. It was a short submachine gun he was familiar with, an Ingram Mach-10. It had been at least 10 years since they'd been manufactured, but he had no doubt it would work. Another man appeared and Sam fired his shotgun again, pumped it and retreated back over the rocks. He heard gunfire coming from up on the wall, 4 rapid shots. He looked up as Remy ducked down. There were 15 or 20 shots fired at the place where she had been, but she stayed low and moved over 10 feet. Sam climbed back on the wall, peered over it, and saw 4 men running toward the entryway. He raised the Mach-10, popped up, and strafed the runners from above. He ducked back, having seen all 4 fall, but the action of the Mach-10 remained open. He had used up the ammunition. There was a storm of bullets pounding the wall now. He sat still on the walkway, waiting for it to subside. It took a while, but gradually silence returned.
How many? Remy called.
7, I think.
I only got 2, she said. When are you going to try your new strategy? Before or after we're out of ammo?
Now might be a good time, he said. He went down the steps to the entryway, looked around the wall to see if any enemies were in sight, but saw none. He restacked the firewood he had piled in the passage, poured some of the whiskey on it, struck a match, and lit a fire. As it grew, he kept his shotgun aimed at the opening beyond. When the fire was flaming high and the resin-dripping branches were blazing torches, he took 4 of them together and ran up to the walkway. He threw 1 of the flaming brands as far as he could over the wall, then each of the other 3 so they landed as widely as possible. He sat down on the walkway again and listened while 30 or 40 rounds glanced uselessly off the high stone wall. Remy made use of the concentrated fire. She fired 3 rounds and then ducked down.
Make that 3, she said.
I'll tell the scorekeeper.
How's our strategy?
Oh my, she said, looking over Sam's side of the wall. Sam looked too. The sky seemed to be lightening.
He took the shotgun and stood up to get a better look, then ducked down as the next volley of shots hit. The torches had started some brush on fire, and the flames were growing, beginning to eat their way into a large thicket where Sam had hidden, crackling and raising sparks. As the gunfire died down, Sam heard men shouting in Spanish. Sam ran downstairs, picked up three still-burning brands, climbed back up, and threw them over the wall on the other side of the enclosure near Remy.
"What are you doing? They're all on that side."
"I'm giving us light and space," he said.
"For what?"
"We'll deprive those guys of hiding places and put them in the light of the fire." She patted his shoulder and smiled, then pointed at the other side of the enclosure. She and Sam crouched, went to that side, and got ready. Then they popped up at the same time, ready to fire. The men were not visible. In the light of the growing fires, Sam stared, but saw nobody.
Remy tugged on the back of his belt. "Don't give them time to aim at you."
Sam ducked. "Listen," he said. "We've driven them back."
"For a while," she said. "As soon as the fire burns that brush away, they'll be back."
Sam shrugged. "It bought us a little time."
"Thanks, Sam. I'll still love you for at least 2 more hours.
"After that, what?"
"We'll see," she said. "It depends on their marksmanship."
They sat on the walkway holding hands. Every few minutes one of them would go along the walk, pick a spot, and pop up to look. The fires flamed along the strip, taking brush and trees, but not going any farther because of the pyramids on each side. As the moon set, Sam looked down the strip.
"I think they'll be coming soon," he said.
"And it looks as though more of them have arrived.
It makes you wonder who they can be."
"This is starting to get depressing," she said.
He went through his pockets. "How much ammo have you got left?"
20 rounds.
8 in each pistol, and 1 spare magazine with only 4 in it.
"I've got 15.
And 5 shells in the shotgun." He hugged her.
"I'm sorry to say.
We're about done." They sat leaning their backs on the wall, silent. Remy sat up straight.
"Sam."
"What?"
"The pool. It's not a cenote, like a well."
"No."
"It has a current. You could barely feel it, but all the artifacts we found were off to the side, and it moved us in the same direction. It's a sinkhole over an underground river."
He looked into her eyes. "Are you saying that's the gamble you'd like to take?" She nodded.
"If we stay here, we run out of bullets, and we'll be at their mercy. I don't want to go that way. I'd rather drown."
"All right," he said. "We'll give it our best try." She glanced out over the wall.
"The fires are about to the end. I can see the men moving down there. We don't have much time."
Sam and Remy hurried down the steps and got their dive equipment ready and changed into their wetsuits. Sam brought the waterproof bag of artifacts out of his pack. "Put the guns, phones, and ammo in here." While Remy gathered them into the bag and sealed it, Sam put a pair of shorts, a t-shirt, and shoes in the net bag for each of them and lowered their pack into the water.
"That's everything," he said. "Maybe they'll think we got out through the fires."
Remy shook the bag.
"Are you able to carry this?"
"It'll make a good weight." He removed the lead weights from his belt and attached the bag to it. Sam and Remy put on the rest of their dive equipment, held their flashlights, and sat on the edge of the pool. He said,
"I'm sorry, it comes down to a long shot."
She leaned over to bump him with her shoulder.
"It's not such a long shot. If there's one sinkhole, there are probably others. We just have to conserve our air to give us more time to find one. We should have about 25 minutes.
He nodded. As he did, there was a ferocious barrage of gunfire that ran along the top of the wall on 3 sides, knocking chips and mortar into the air. Sam and Remy turned their heads to kiss. Then they put on their masks, inserted their mouthpieces, and slid into the water. They swam downward for 10 or 12 feet, and then felt the slow current catch them, and begin to push them gently away.
Chapter 12. Guatemala. Sam and Remy swam cautiously in the deepening darkness, just going with the current for about 100 feet to make sure that no one standing above the cenote could see them turn on their flashlights, and they increased their speed to move along the stone corridor of the underground river. The water rose all the way to the ceiling of the cavern, leaving no airspace above the surface. At first, the walls were about 20 feet apart, but 30 or 40 feet deep. Each time the space between the walls narrowed, Sam and Remy would feel a growing dread. When the space opened up a little, their relief was intense. They kicked their fins steadily to keep their speed up, and the current helped them along. They held their flashlights ahead of them, but what they saw was always the same. More curving tunnel. When the tunnel narrowed, Sam would wonder whether it was merely a fissure in the rock opened up by one of the frequent earthquakes in the region. If it was, it could narrow at some point from 20 feet down to 6 inches, and they would be trapped and drowned. Sam kept checking his watch as they swam. He and Remy had made a dive yesterday morning that had lasted about 15 minutes. Each of their aluminum tanks still held about 25 minutes of air. That meant that for the first 12 minutes, if they reached an obstacle, they might still be able to swim back to the cenote and surface. Maybe if they did, they'd find that the men who had been after them had already stormed the enclosure, seen they were gone, and left to search for them. Sam knew this thought was part fantasy and part nightmare. The possibility that betting their lives on this underground river might be a dead end. And then it was 13 minutes, and he knew that if they tried to swim back, they probably wouldn't make it before their air was gone. After 5 more minutes, they certainly wouldn't. When 20 minutes had passed, they could count on only 5 more minutes of air. Even that might be optimistic. They had been swimming steadily, so they had used air at an accelerated rate. He thought about their chances as rationally as he could. There was no reason to believe that they would reach another opening in the ground above them in the next 5 minutes. Remy was smaller and lighter and used less air than he did. If she had both tanks, she would have twice as much time to find an escape. Sam shifted his tank to the side so he could turn off the valve, but Remy saw what he was doing. She grasped his wrist with surprising strength and shook her head violently. Sam realized that she must have been thinking the same thoughts, feeling the same fears, and known that Sam would try to give her his tank. When Remy had grasped Sam's wrist, his flashlight had swept the space above them, and something had looked different. Now he looked back and upward. He had gotten used to the sight of the bubbles they exhaled rising to the ceiling of the cavern, sliding into a depression and staying there as a single gelatinous bubble. Now his bubbles disappeared. He swam upward, with Remy still holding his wrist. They broke the surface together and aimed their flashlights upward. They were in a dome, with the limestone ceiling about 10 feet above their heads. Sam removed his mouthpiece and cautiously took a shallow breath. "The air is good," he announced. Remy took out her mouthpiece. They raised their masks and looked around. "I was afraid it would be carbon monoxide or hydrogen sulfide or something from a volcano," she said. "Nope. Just air." "It's sweet, clean air," she said. "How is it getting in?" "Let's turn off the flashlights and see if light is coming in." They tried the experiment, but there was no light. They waited for their eyes to adjust to the darkness, but they still detected nothing. They switched on their flashlights again. "At least we can swim on the surface for a bit," said Sam. They closed the valves on their tanks and began to move. The space remained above them, and they breathed the air and swam steadily along with the current. Sam paused. "I think I know what this is." "You do?" she said. "Rainwater that flows into cenotes or seeps in through cracks feeds the river. The water level must be very high after a rain, maybe even through the rainy season, and then gets lower as time passes."
Sounds right, she said. It would explain why the Mayans built those big stone strips like gutters, to catch the rain and direct it to the pool. When there's no rain for a while, much of the underground river probably gets low, and air flows in above it. When the river rises again, air gets trapped in places like this, Sam said. We've got to try to stay on the surface as long as we can to save our air. And, by the way, said Remy, don't make any more moves like trying to give me your air tank. I'm already aware that chivalry isn't dead. I was just being rational, he said. You use less air than I do, so you could make it last longer and get farther. All that would accomplish is that we'd both die alone. I plan to die in front of an audience, and I picked mine years ago. You're it. Saves you having to send out a lot of invitations, he said. That's right, she said. This is hard enough with you alive. Just stick with me and curb your generosity. They swam on along the curving tunnel for an hour until they came to a spot where the wall ahead reached all the way down under the water. They stopped and held on to the wall long enough for an awkward kiss. Then they lowered their masks over their faces and turned on the valves of their tanks. Remy said, "Remember, it's both of us or neither," and put her mouthpiece in. They sank and found themselves in a long passage that looked exactly like the stretches they had first passed through. As they swam, Remy wished she had looked at her watch before they had submerged. She had timed their arrival at the air pocket at 16 minutes, but how much time had gone by? And did their tanks actually hold 9 more minutes of air? She and Sam had never tested the limits before. Letting their air get this low would have been risky and stupid on any day when they could have simply surfaced and gotten fresh tanks from the dive boat. There was nothing she could do but swim. As the minutes ticked away, the passage opened into another, wider space. The bottom of the river was oddly uneven, with loose chunks of rock instead of the smooth, worn riverbed they'd seen before. Then she realized she was seeing these things outside the perimeter of their flashlight beams. Real light was filtering down from above. They swam upward. As the light grew brighter, Remy laughed and heard herself make a squeaky noise like a dolphin. She saw Sam huff out a big flurry of bubbles in an answering laugh, and they broke the surface smiling. But Remy's laugh caught in her throat. There was light in this dome, directly above their heads, coming from a circular hole that opened to the starry sky. But the hole was at the center of the dome, beyond their reach, at least 6 feet above the surface of the river. "Now there's a problem," Sam said.
"What can we do?"
"I'm going down to take a look around. Stay here for a minute." He lowered his mask again and submerged. Remy waited until he surfaced again.
"Well," she said.
Sam swam over to the side of the stone riverbed. It seemed to rise in the water, then rose part way out of it, so he was only up to his waist. "I'm standing on a pile of rock. At some point, a pretty big chunk of wall came down right here. There's also a pile in the center, right below where the roof collapsed."
"Very dramatic," she said.
"Does this mean we're not going to the great beyond?" Sam looked up at the hole in the dome. "I think it does. But we'll have to work pretty hard to get out. Get ready to move some stones." They dove to the bottom where Sam had been standing and began to move chunks of stone from the pile along the wall to the spot just below the opening. Sam moved the largest chunks he could, rolling them end over end to add to the pile in the center. Soon he took off his fins and worked in his booties. It was clear that at some point part of the wall had collapsed to make the pile, and stones gradually falling from the ceiling formed the cenote, with even more stones coming down as it enlarged. Sam and Remy both were free diving, and they had to stop occasionally to catch their breaths. When they had moved the whole pile of stone from the place where it had fallen to the place they wanted it, they stopped at the surface. "We're running out of stones," said Remy.
"I think we've got to bet the rest of our air on finding more and building higher."
"I'm for risking it," she said. "This is the only chance we're likely to get."
They put on their tanks again, swam in a wider radius around the pile they'd built, and brought back chunks of limestone that must have been left by other collapses. They didn't bother to pile the rocks high, just brought them and then went back for more, knowing the air in their tanks must be nearly gone. After a few more minutes, Sam surfaced and took off his tank.